Chapter 84. Of course, by the strict rules of grammar, and therefore a suit for recovery could not lie. In German, all the nouns begin with a capital letter. Now that is a good idea, and a good idea, in this language, is necessarily conspicuous from its lonesomeness. I consider this capitalizing of nouns a good idea, because by reason of it, you are almost always able to tell a noun the minute you see it. You fall into error occasionally, because you mistake the name of a person for the name of a thing, and waste a good deal of time trying to dig a meaning out of it. German names almost always do mean something, and this helps to deceive the student. I translated a passage one day, which said that the infuriated tigress broke loose, and utterly ate up the unfortunate fir forest Tannenwald. When I was girding up my loins to doubt this, I found out that Tannenwald in this instance was a man's name. Every noun has a gender, and there is no sensor system in the distribution. So the gender of each must be learned separately and by heart. There is no other way. To do this, one has to have a memory like a memorandum book. In German, a young lady has no sex, while a turnip has. Think what overwrought reverence that shows for the turnip, and what callous disrespect for the girl. See how it looks in print. I translate this from a conversation in one of the best of the German Sunday school books. Gretchen. Wilhelm, where is the turnip? Wilhelm. As he has gone to the kitchen. Gretchen. Where is the accomplished and beautiful English maiden? Wilhelm. It has gone to the opera. To continue with the German genders. A tree is male, its buds are female, its leaves are neuter, horses are sexless, dogs are male, cats are female, tomcats included, of course. A person's mouth, neck, bosom, elbows, fingers, nails, feet, and body are of the male sex, and his head is male, or neuter according to the word selected to signify it, and not according to the sex of the individual who wears it, for in Germany all the women either male heads or sexless ones. A person's nose, lips, shoulders, breast, hands, and toes are of the female sex, and his hair, ears, eyes, chin, legs, knees, heart, and conscience haven't any sex at all. The inventor of the language probably got what he knew about a conscience from hearsay. Now, by the above dissection, the reader will see that in Germany a man may think he is a man, but when he comes to look into the matter closely, he is bound to have his doubts. He finds that in sober truth he is a most ridiculous mixture. And if he ends by trying to comfort himself with the thought that he can at least depend on a third of this mess as being manly and masculine, the humiliating second thought will quickly remind him that in this respect he is no better off than any woman or cow in the land. In the German it is true that by some oversight of the inventor of the language, a woman is a female, but a wife, weib, is not, which is unfortunate. A wife, here, has no sex. She is neuter. So, according to the grammar, a fish is he, his scales are she, but a fishwife is neither. To describe a wife as sexless may be called under description. That is bad enough, but over description is surely worse. A German speaks of an Englishman as the Englander. To change the sex, he adds in, and that stands for Englishwoman, Engländerin. That seems descriptive enough, but still it is not exact enough for a German, so he precedes the word with that article which indicates that the creature to follow is feminine, and writes it down thus : die Engländerin, which means he, she, Englishwoman. I consider that that person is over-described. Well, after the student has learned the sex of a great number of nouns, he is still in a difficulty, because he finds it impossible to persuade his tongue to refer to things as he, and him and her, which it has been always accustomed to refer to it as t. When he even frames a German sentence in his mind, with the hims and hers in the right places, and then works up his courage to the utterance point, it is no use. The moment he begins to speak, his tongue files the track, and all those labored males and females come out as ts. And even when he is reading German to himself, he always calls those things tea, whereas he ought to read in this way. Tale of the Fishwife and its Sad Fate, 2. I capitalize the nouns, in the German and ancient English, fashion. It is a bleak day. Hear the rain, how he pours, and the hail, how he rattles, and see the snow, how he drifts along, and of the mud, how deep he is. Ah, the poor fishwife, it is stuck fast in the mire, it has dropped its basket of fishes, and its hands have been cut by the scales as it seized some of the fallen creatures, and one scale has even got into its eye, and it cannot get her out. It opens its mouth to cry for help, but if any sound comes out of him, alas, he is drowned by the raging of the storm. And now a tomcat has got one of the fishes and she will surely escape with him. No, she bites off a fin, she holds her in her mouth, will she swallow her? No, the fishwife's brave mother dog deserts his puppies, and rescues the fin which he eats, himself, as his reward. Oh, horror, the lightning has struck the fish basket. He sets him on fire. See the flame, how she licks the doomed utensil with her red and angry tongue. Now she attacks the helpless fishwife's foot, she burns him up, all but the big toe, and even she is partly consumed. And still she spreads, still she waves her fiery tongues. She attacks the fishwife's leg and destroys it. She attacks its hand, and destroys her also. She attacks the fishwife's leg, and destroys her also. She attacks its body and consumes him. She rears herself about its heart, and it is consumed. Next about its breast, and in a moment she is a cinder. Now she reaches its neck, he goes. Now its chin, it goes. Now its nose, she goes. In another moment, except help come, the fishwife will be no more. Time presses, is there none to succor and save? Yes. Joy, joy, with flying feet the she Englishwoman comes. But alas, the generous she female is too late. Where now is the fated fishwife? It has ceased from its sufferings, it has gone to a better land. All that is left of it for its loved ones to lament over, is this poor smoldering ash heap. Ah, woeful, woeful ash heap. Let us take him up tenderly, reverently, upon the lowly shovel, and bear him to his long rest, with the prayer, that when he rises again it will be a realm, where he will have one good square responsible sex, and have it all to himself, instead of having a mangy lot of assorted sexes, scattered all over him in spots. There, now, the reader can see for himself, that this pronoun business is a very awkward thing for the unaccustomed tongue. I suppose that in all languages the similarities of look and sound between words which have no similarity in meaning are a fruitful source of perplexity to the foreigner. It is so in our tongue, and it is notably the case in the German. Now there is that troublesome word Vermut. To me it has so close a resemblance, either real or fancied, to three or four other words, that I never know whether it means despised, painted, suspected, or married, until I look in the dictionary, and then I find it means the latter. There are lots of such words and they are a great torment. To increase the difficulty there are words which seem to resemble each other, and yet do not, but they make just as much trouble as if they did. For instance, there is the word vermiathan, to let, to lease, to hire, and the word verherithan, another way of saying to marry. I heard of an Englishman who knocked at a man's door in Heidelberg and proposed, in the best German he could command, to verherithan that house. Then there are some words which mean one thing, when you emphasize the first syllable, but mean something very different, if you throw the emphasis on the last syllable. For instance, there is a word which means a runaway, or the act of glancing through a book, according to the placing of the emphasis, and another word which signifies to associate with a man, or to avoid him, according to where you put the emphasis, and you can generally depend on putting it in the wrong place, and getting into trouble. There are some exceedingly useful words in this language. Schlag, for example, and zug. There are three quarters of a column of schlags in the dictionary, and a column and a half of zugs. The word schlag means blow, stroke, dash, hit, shock, clap, slap, time, bar, coin, stamp, kind, sort, manner, way, apoplexy, wood cutting, enclosure, field, forest clearing. This is its simple and exact meaning, that is to say, it's restricted, it's fettered meaning. But there are ways by which you can set it free, so that it can soar away, as on the wings of the morning, and never be at rest. You can hang any word you please to its tail, and make it mean anything you want to. You can begin with Schlagader, which means artery, and you can hang on the whole dictionary, word by word, clear through the alphabet to Schlagwasser, which means bilgewater, and including Schlagmutter, which means mother-in-law. Just the same with Zug. Strictly speaking, Zug means pull, tug, draft, procession, march, progress, flight, direction, expedition, train, caravan, passage, stroke, touch, line, flourish, trait of character, feature, lineament, chess move, organ stop, team, whiff, bias, drawer, propensity, inhalation, disposition. But that thing which it does not mean when all its legitimate pennants have been hung on, has not been discovered yet. One cannot overestimate the usefulness of Schlag and Zug. Armed just with these two, and the word also, what cannot the foreigner on German soil accomplish? The German word also is the equivalent of the English phrase Uno, and does not mean anything at all in talk, though it sometimes does in print. Every time a German opens his mouth and also falls out, and every time he shuts it, he bites one in two that was trying to get out. Now, the foreigner, equipped with these three noble words, is master of the situation. Let him talk right along, fearlessly. Let him pour his indifferent German forth, and when he lacks for a word, let him heave a Schlag into the vacuum. All the chances are that it fits it like a plug. But if it doesn't, let him promptly heave a Zug after it. The two together can hardly fail to bung the hole. But if, by a miracle, they should fail, let him simply say also, and this will give him a moment's chance to think of the needful word. In Germany, when you load your conversational gun, it is always best to throw in a Schlag, or two, and a Zug or two, because it doesn't make any difference how much the rest of the charge may scatter, you are bound to back something with them. Then you blandly say also, and load up again. Nothing gives such an air of grace and elegance, and unconstraint to a German or an English conversation, as to scatter it full of so's or who knows. In my notebook I find this entry. July 1. In the hospital yesterday, a word of 13 syllables was successfully removed from a patient, a North German from near Hamburg. But as most unfortunately the surgeons had opened him in the wrong place, under the impression that he contained a panorama, he died. The sad event has cast a gloom over the whole community. That paragraph furnishes a text for a few remarks about one of the most curious and notable features of my subject, the length of German words. Some German words are so long that they have a perspective. Observe these examples. Freundschaftsbesegungen. Dilettantenaufdringlichkeiten. Stadtverordnetenversammlungen. These things are not words, they are alphabetical processions. And they are not rare. One can open a German newspaper at any time and see them marching majestically across the page, and if he has any imagination he can see the banners and hear the music too. They impart a martial thrill to the meekest subject. I take a great interest in these curiosities. Whenever I come across a good one, I stuff it and put it in my museum. In this way I have made quite a valuable collection. When I get duplicates, I exchange with other collectors, and thus increase the variety of my stock. Here are some specimens which I lately bought at an auction sale of the effects of a bankrupt bric-a-brac hunter. Generalstützverordnetenversammlungen. Alterthumswissenschaften. Kinderbuerungsanstalten. Unabhängigkeitserklärungen. Wiederherstellungsbestrebungen. Waffenstillstandsunterhandlungen. Of course, when one of these grand mountain ranges goes stretching across the printed page, it adorns and ennobles that literary landscape, but at the same time it is a great distress to the new student, for it blocks up his way. He cannot crawl under it, or climb over it, or tunnel through it. So he resorts to the dictionary for help, but there is no help there. The dictionary must draw the line somewhere so it leaves this sort of words out. And it is right, because these long things are hardly legitimate words, but are rather combinations of words, and the inventor of them ought to have been killed. They are compound words with the hyphens left out. The various words used in building them are in the dictionary, but in a very scattered condition. So you can hunt the materials out, one by one, and get at the meaning at last, but it is a tedious and harassing business. I have tried this process upon some of the above examples. Freundschaftsbesigungen seems to be friendship demonstrations, which is only a foolish and clumsy way of saying demonstrations of friendship. Unabhängigkeit zur Klärungen seems to be independence declarations, which is no improvement upon declarations of independence, so far as I can see. Generalstatsverordneten versammlungen seems to be Generalstatsrepräsentatives meetings, as nearly as I can get at it a mere rhythmical, gushy euphemism for meetings of the legislature, I judge. We used to have a good deal of this sort of crime in our literature, but it has gone out now. We used to speak of a thing as a never-to-be-forgotten circumstance, instead of cramping. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.